You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. The Oxford Executive MBA enables current and future business leaders to make a difference in their chosen field. The part-time program is designed to fit alongside your work commitments and offers you a global network. Visit the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford website for further details.
Welcome everyone to the latest Social Europe podcast. My name is Robin Wilson, Acting Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. My guest today is Philippe Terre, Professor of Central European History at the University of Vienna and author, most recently, of The Outsiders, Refugees in Europe Since 1492. Many thanks, Philippe, for giving generously of your time.
Many thanks for the invitation.
In 2015, Philippe, Europe experienced what was widely described in the media as a refugee crisis. You described the point of departure, as you put it, of your book in these terms: integration has proved to be a better means for solving refugee crises, real and imagined, than the most futile attempts to build walls and fences or the resort to violent measures like the imposition of the Iron Curtain. Which evokes two questions. First, was the 2015 crisis, in your view, real or imagined? And secondly, what is the evidence from European history that building walls and fences is indeed futile?
Well, thanks for your first question. I think in many ways it was an exaggeration to call it a refugee crisis, and that was already part of the political problem. Why do I consider it to be an exaggeration? And that is because if you look in earlier periods of European history, then indeed the numbers of the refugees arriving in 2015 and 16, they dwarf, they are minimized. If we, for example, look at the time after World War I, there were many more people put on flight, and there was a much higher number of refugees also in proportion to the general population of Europe. Around 6-7 million people were then, so to say, on the roads in Europe. And well, that compares with around 1.5 million or maybe 2 million all in all in 2015 and 2016, with a much higher population. And if you look to the period after World War II, then the difference is even more pronounced. After World War II, around 3-4% of the world population was on flight. So that is, again, much, much higher in the general number than we are seeing them in the past decade, which indeed has been a period when you have a lot of civil wars, a lot of warfare, regional conflicts, like after the Arab Spring in Syria. So there is indeed a rising number of refugees in the past decade, and that is tragic, and that is really bad and something to do about for the international community. But compared to earlier periods, which might have been forgotten, that is not a very high number. Of course, for Syria itself and its immediate neighbors, that was a real refugee crisis. I mean, there, if you look at countries like Lebanon or Turkey, which is taking in up to 4 million refugees, with a general population of 80 million, that is indeed a major crisis, a humanitarian crisis, a major problem on the labor market. But for Europe, the smaller Europe, we know that parts of Turkey are located in Europe, but for the smaller Europe, for the EU, the numbers were not that high. However, then it became a political crisis. So it was a crisis about the political management of the refugees arriving. So that was then the problem, the disunity of the European Union, but also the disunity of the disunity of what was once considered the West in dealing with this tragedy. So this was the major problem then, and it is not resolved until now. Now, why is it not resolved? That is a very complicated political question. But again, as a historian, you know, you look at the past, and there have been much better mechanisms and much more, you can say, unity within the community of Western states to go about problems with major refugee movements, especially if you look to the Cold War period. But even in the 1990s, there have been much more productive approaches. There was a system how to distribute refugees between states. Usually they were voluntarily, these mechanisms, so there was no quota that each country would have had to take in a certain amount of refugees. But even the ones who were in great trouble themselves in the 1950s and the 60s took in a pretty high number of refugees. And so, you know, by sharing the burden, the problem was resolved. This is, by the way, also true on a more global level with the so-called Indochina refugees. So hence the Vietnamese, but also Cambodians and Laotians escaping from the wars there in the late 1970s. So again, there was a mechanism how to share the burden, how to distribute the refugees, and this was the way how to solve past humanitarian crises. And that was clearly missing in 2015, in 2016 in the European Union. And I think this is actually the main crisis and what we may call a crisis, but not the refugees themselves. I don't like the term refugee crisis also that much, because in a way, it puts the attention towards the refugees, in a way blames them, puts the problem on them, and not on the states or the community of states, the European Union, which was not able to deal with that problem in a constructive way. Now let's come to the second question, the second part of your question. Please interrupt if I'm talking too much. The second part of the question was the evidence from European history, the building walls and fences is futile. Well, that was attempted several times. I mean, we could even go back to medieval times, and it never worked. I mean, human beings are always very inventive in overcoming walls. This is why the Berlin Wall came down, why the Iron Curtain didn't hold up. And there were also previous experiences, for example, with the French Huguenots, where it was not permitted to emigrate, not permitted to flee from France. And nevertheless, so many people overcame this challenge and eventually made it to the countries of arrival. So building walls and fences might look like a long-term solution. It might abhor some refugees, and of course it might abhor migrants, but in the long run, this is not going to be a solution. And there have been smarter solutions in the past.
You say, Philip, that the Europe of Walls approach isn't the answer, but you also question the attitude taken from the other side of the argument, if you like, by some non-governmental and humanitarian organizations who, you argue, depict refugees as weak and needy to attract support and indeed donations. Why is that wrong?
Oh, I'm not saying it is wrong. It might be good to, you know, to get donations and to get attention to problems. So I'm not condemning that as wrong, but it might be counterproductive in one particular way. It turns the refugees into, first of all, needy people only who need support. Well, of course they need it, but it also turns them into passive objects of history. And refugees, and of course also other migrants, labor migrants, which need to be distinguished. Refugees were not just objects of history, they are also subjects of history, and we need to understand them as such in order to apply some degree of human dignity and humanity to them. And that is one point, more on the philosophical side. But the other one is also to get the right picture about refugees. Now, this is in some ways what I will say now in a minute is probably in some ways contradictory to a purely humanitarian agenda. But if we analyze the social composition of refugees, then we see through all times of history that usually there is a social selection at hand. A social selection, this has happened before. Fleeing from a country depends on a lot of resources, money, but above all, education, that you know how to leave and how to get somewhere, you know geography, that you know geography, and so on. So you have something like a social bias. Usually the people who arrive are rather, or who survive, are rather the well-educated ones and very often also the richer ones. Now, this social selection is in contradiction to those pictures of, you know, the needy and the destitute. And it came to the fore, this contradiction, in a short moment when the countries of arrival in Europe, some parts of the population and right-wing populist parties were saying, hey, look at these refugees. They have mobile phones. They even have some of them expensive smartphones. How can be? Yeah, of course they have it, because it was not the most poor ones who got out of Syria, but rather the middle class or even parts of the upper middle class. Now, this social selection, of course, contradicts in to some degree this picture of neediness, which of course might still be there. I mean, if rich people or the middle class is threatened and suffers from violence and war and all that, then of course it still deserves protection, right? Even if it is not maybe the poorest echelons of society. But nevertheless, because there is this social preselection in almost all processes of mass flight, there are some exceptions, but in most of them, it also means there is an advantage in the countries of arrival and for the countries of arrival. Usually the people who come have resources. They are the more active ones, the more educated ones, and very often they're middle-class people who even have some resources. And that, of course, makes it easier for them to get somewhere, but also to start a new life somewhere. And so that kind of confirms the proven fact, which I'm also showing in my book, that refugees, taking in refugees, is usually to the benefit of the receiving societies. But it, of course, doesn't give a clear answer about the sending societies, the countries of departure, who suffer from this drain of human resources. But for the countries of arrival, it usually pays off to take in refugees. Now, how to organize this taking in, then also how they can start a new life, how to support them in an effective way, that is another complicated issue. But nevertheless, I think it is very important to show that refugees are active people, they have resources, and that helps them to start a new life and to get away from this maybe a little bit, you know, romanticized caregiving picture of, okay, you know, we are supporting the most needy ones and the most destitute ones, which of course we should do as well, but there's various ways to do that, not only by taking them, by resettling refugees, but also by helping on the spot.
Okay, Philip, so you're saying that we should see refugees as subjects of history rather than simply passive objects. You're saying that they tend to be a self-selecting group characterized by perhaps a disproportionate degree of resourcefulness and resilience, and therefore, rather than being a burden, they can actually, in the long run, if refugee integration is well managed, be a boon for the host society. But to play devil's advocate, someone taking a contrary view would say, yes, but what about the cost accommodating the refugees, of the language courses, of the support while they're integrating into the labour market, and so on. Surely these costs, it would be argued, would offset any potential benefits. What's your response to that?
Well, there are costs, but there are also benefits. And yes, initially it may be expensive to accommodate refugees, especially in a wealthy country with a welfare state. And then if you have transfer payments, yes, it can be very expensive. And there are estimations that, for example, the German government spend around 20 billion per year in the initial years for accommodating the refugees and all the support programs. So that is indeed expensive. But it was money well spent. And this is, by the way, also a reason why many employers, why why the German industry was supporting that. They were seeing that they, you know, that they getting people who want to work, some of whom got some education, who are motivated, and of course then it takes a while until you train the language, until you train arriving refugees to really function on the labor market of the receiving country. But that has worked remarkably well. You know, when I was stating that in my book, first in the German version in 2017 and then in the English version in 2019, I received a lot of criticism and even some shitstorms. But actually, this utilitarian argument that it will pay off, that is held up. And the labor market statistics are remarkably well. Already more than half of the refugees who have arrived in 2015, 2016 are working in Germany. So, they start to pay taxes. So in the long run, this is paying off, especially for countries which have an aging population. So that, of course, is again a tricky argument, because it is an argument which you can also use for taking in labor migrants. So again, you know, this it's getting tricky and might conflate the boundary between labor migrants and refugees. But anyway, so far that has paid off. Of course, that might not be true for every country. If a country is in a bad economic situation, if it has a high rate of unemployment, if it is much poorer, it might be much more difficult. And this, you know, calculation, how much you spend and how much you benefit might lead to different results. But anyway, countries who were fairly open, even poor ones, like post-partition India, for example, after 1947, I think that was an important argument for an Anglophone audience. Even poor countries usually over the decades had a payoff. It might have cost money in the very beginning, but you gain flexible, motivated people who want to start a new life. You get people who want to work. So especially if you're in need of labor force, it might pay off. Now, it always depends on the country, on the economic context, all that. But nevertheless, to come back to this 2015-2016 refugees, they are doing, compared to the not very high expectations, they're doing remarkably well. Of course, that doesn't mean that there are no problems. Of course, there are tons of problems. Not all of them were well trained. Learning a language, especially if you're a little older, is really difficult. Now, to give them jobs which are on their level of previous education, you know, not to downgrade them, is difficult. 75% of them in the age group between 16 and 30 who arrived in Germany were male. So, you know, how to establish a family, the social integration. So there are many complicating factors. And I don't want to paint a rosy picture at all. But nevertheless, I would like to keep up that the initial fears were contradicted and the initial hopes and expectations were confirmed.
Well, one thing we can say, Philip, you're an historian, as you say, and your book goes back to 1492, and if the jury is still out on the long-term impact of the influx of 2015 to 16, at least we can speak with more certainty, as you do in the book, about the experience of the French Huguenots, who you mentioned earlier on. Can you just say some more about the Huguenots and what the historical experience of their exile over the decades says about the argument you're making?
Yeah, I'm happy to tell about the Huguenots list. Of course, the insight that this is long, long ago, the end of the 17th century, and then, you know, after the arrival, okay, the 18th century, very different circumstances, a high degree of religious solidarity in the countries of arrival, and, well, they were really well educated and some of them rich. So it was indeed an elite flight. So, it, you know, very different and in some ways not comparable to current or most recent refugees. Nevertheless, the French Huguenots are important because in many ways they're very European experience. They went to Prussia, so today parts of Germany, Berlin, and so on. They went to early modern England, to Ireland, overseas, to the United States, to the Netherlands. So it is a very European experience. And they ushered in a lot of economic changes that was especially visible and pronounced that the countries of arrival profited from taking the name. But they also were very important for European history, because in some ways they ushered in an age of more tolerance. This was also the age of religious war and religious conflict. Well, that's why they had to leave. And the conflict between Protestant countries or Protestant rulers and Catholic ones and the Counter-Reformation was also carried out as a war of propaganda and public opinion. And, you know, France suddenly looked bad as a very intolerant country, whereas the countries of arrival could present themselves as basically, you know, harbingers of freedom, even of some versions of human rights, of human dignity. And so they looked very good. And in many ways, one could argue that the Protestant countries won this war propaganda. Also, de facto, not all of them were that tolerant, for example, having conflicts between Lutherans and Calvinists and so on. But anyway, they could present themselves as tolerant. They profited economically from the intake of the refugees, while the countries where the Huguenots or other Protestant refugees were coming from, they suffered economically. And in the long run, this had, of course, a feedback effect on the countries where the refugees came from. They were mostly Catholic countries. And so, you know, in the early 18th century, around 1731, counter-reformation countries, Catholic countries, stopped pushing out refugees in high numbers, religious minorities in high numbers, because they saw that first of all, it would do economic damage, but also they recognize that this is not good in public opinion and for their political image. So there was a not just France against the Netherlands and England, this kind of conflict, but also Prussia versus the Habsburg Empire, the Habsburgs. And the Habsburgs eventually also passed laws of toleration for religious minorities, first for Protestants, later on for Jews and other minorities. And so in a way that the Enlightenment values are also based on this experience of the mass expulsion and the mass flight of the Huguenots. So most of them had to stay in France because they couldn't get out and they couldn't afford to get out. And so one also always needs to keep those people in mind who had to stay. But nevertheless, it is an interesting European experience with far-reaching consequences.
One of the interesting legacies of that, oddly, Philippe, is, of course, that perhaps the single most important figure in the Brexit episode in the UK in recent years, Nigel Farage, is of Huguenot extraction, which suggests he may have been engaging in some unconscious self-denial about his own roots in that regard, in becoming such a more English than the English English nationalist. But more seriously, for nearly two decades, I've been an expert advisor to the Council of Europe on intercultural integration. And through that global standard setting work, the notion has emerged of the so-called diversity advantage that, as you say, if it's well managed, diversity brings dynamism and vibrancy to societies from which everyone can benefit, not just migrants and refugees. And to pursue your example of Germany, just in the last a month or so, a piece of research has been published showing that innovation, the rate of innovation is rising in Germany, even though it is falling among indigenous Germans, partly because of the demographic factor you mentioned earlier. But it is rising overall because of the soaring contribution by individuals who don't have what you might describe as German-sounding names. So how, finally, Philip, should progressive political forces in Europe go on the front foot on the issue that has been labelled immigration over the years and on which they have been very much on the defensive?
Well, this is the $1,000 political question, right? And if mainstream conservatives or liberal conservatives in Great Britain and the Labour Party had a good answer, then probably Britain would still be a member of the European Union. And I think this is still regrettable because it was, of course, very much about the migration issue and so to say, a symbolic event against diversity and against multinationalism and multilateralism. And I think we at first need to recover from that shock. You know, continental Europeans. But you pertain to the German example, and so let's talk about Germany, which indeed has turned itself into an immigration country in the past 60 years, actually now almost 75 years since the first guest workers arrived. Of course, it became an immigration country in many ways after World War II, when there was this massive influx of refugees from Eastern Europe. And some of them were indeed, you know, German Germans, but very many of them had a very different cultural traditions and different accents and were, so to say, not that German. So that already added a kind of a mixture. Anyway, coming back to the guest workers, for quite a long time, the experience with the guest workers has mostly been discussed in negative terms, that there's so many problems. And indeed, there are a lot of problems. If you look at social statistics, if you look at the income statistics, if you look at the social investment and all that, it is not easy. And many of the migrants, by the way, also in some ways comparable to Great Britain, who took in, you know, cheap labor jobs in the industry were suffering from deindustrialization since the 1980s. So they were, in a way, victimized by the economic changes and also by parts of the economic globalization since the 1980s. So there's a lot of problems. However, in the past, I think, 5 years, 10 years, there has been a slightly different debate showing to the benefits. And that indeed Germany has profited from that. And that was also one of the reasons why Germany, I think, was, besides the good economy and the good labor market, was a relatively open country in 2015-16 with the refugee crisis. You know, every country needs to be able to afford it to take in people. And it also has to do with economic well-being, a good labor market, whether a country is rather open or whether it's rather closed, like Britain after the global financial crisis after 2009. I mean, Brexit also has a background there. And Germany was more lucky in its economic development. And Now, that economic development, and that is increasingly recognized, is indeed influenced by the influx of migrants. Because even if the first generation didn't really do well in some cases, or the second, then still you might have very ambitious people in the third generation, and you might have new migrants coming in. Now, there has been the Corona crisis and this symbolic moment. The vaccination program for German, or you can say, well, it's connected with an American company, with Pfizer, BioNTech, which invented the vaccination. It is a German company founded by two immigrants from Turkey. Now, I have grown up in Turkey for some years, so I know Turkey very well, and actually I've published about it. They have an interesting background, I would say. Ms. Türeci, she's a doctor's child, so in a way she came from an academic family and then a fairly privileged background. But anyway, so her parents, you know, paid her an education and let her study, which is not always the case with Muslim immigrant families. But anyway, she clearly benefited from that, and her husband, he indeed has a different background. There's a lot of social advancement on his side. It's a little bit like a version of, you know, the dishwasher to the billionaire myth, which you have in the United States. His father was a worker in the Ford factory in Cologne. But he had a very smart son, and so he went to high school, to the gymnasium, studied, and he made a fantastic career, and then was a very good entrepreneur after his study. And he took the risk of developing this very special vaccine. It's a new kind of vaccination. It's not like AstraZeneca, which is more traditional in many ways. And it is a huge success. And I think that has demonstrated to Germans that, hey, you know, here's basically a migrant kid. And he has built up this company and invented the BioNTech vaccination, which is then produced and distributed in cooperation with Pfizer. By the way, if you look to Moderna and in the United States and the CEO of that company, you see, again, a lot of immigrants. And I think this has been really, really important for the debate in Germany. And my main hope is that it will also trigger a debate among the migrants themselves. You know, we always talk about the migrants. I think it would be much more important to talk with the migrants, and that there's a discourse going on among the migrants how to achieve something, and that it instills more optimism, especially to the ones who, you know, might live in bad quarters of town and might not have received a good education, and might even be welfare recipients, that they get a degree of hope that, okay, with a good education and hard work and a good sense of business, you can get very far. Of course, Mr. Shahin and Mrs. Türeci are now among the richest Germans, and they deserved it so much. And I think this is very important for changing the discourse. Now, what does that mean for politics? Okay, we have so many examples. I think they should be named and presented. That is very important. We should not always be on the defensive about migration. Migration is, of course, also not a solution for all demographic problems, labor market problems. I mean, we can't solve those by just pertaining to migration, and also, you know, the refugees welcome, take them in, all of them. But that's also impossible. So there are always limitations for every receiving society, and they also should be openly discussed. I mean, I'm not a migration romantic, because I'm a migration historian. I know the problems all too well. But anyway, on a political level, I think it is very important to show that indeed the receiving societies have benefited from taking in refugees, but also from taking in labor migrants. And now that implies also some degree of realism and not romanticism. and it relies a lot of political decision making on how to foster the talents of the migrants. But if that is properly done, if a society indeed is, you know, socially mobile, and if it allows migrants and by the way also their own members of, you know, the formerly called, you know, lower classes to rise up, that is as important to allow that social mobility to people who are already here and who might have many problems and, you know, the underprivileged of our days. So there needs to be general awareness how to raise social mobility, and it's not just about migrants. But anyway, here we have had examples about migrants, and I think that needs to be communicated on a rational level with all the utilitarian arguments I've used, but also on an emotional level. And on an emotional level, there's been so much bashing of multiculturalism that I won't make now a big argument in favor of multiculturalism, but I think, you know, let's just think about food. And imagine ourselves, you know, 50 years back, let's say, in the United Kingdom. I was lucky that because of a school exchange, I was in Great Britain. I remember the food in the boarding school where I had the privilege to stay without paying it for 3 months. That was very different than what you eat in London nowadays, or even in the, you know, in the Midlands, and even in poor parts of Britain. So let's think about food, but also let's think about culture, about music, so many things, so many aspects of our daily life. Also now among in the midst of the COVID crisis, I mean, who is doing the home delivery of the food? And who might not be, you know, properly rewarded for that by getting vaccinations and a decent salary. But anyway, again, migrants, nurses, doctors. And I hope that, so to say, the current pandemic will also raise the awareness that, you know, we are in much better shape being open societies and socially mobile societies.
Yes, Philippe, and I've had the good fortune, because of my age, to have a double dose of the BioNTech vaccine. And as you say, it's designed on the incredibly inventive basis of using messenger RNA rather than the conventional approach of inoculating people with a simply disabled version of the virus. So it is a fascinating case in point. I'm also a foodie, and my favorite chef is Yota Matalengi, the an Israeli chef who grew up in Jewish quarters in Jerusalem, but happily sampled the street food on the Arab side, and has some very interesting fusion dishes that he has created as a result. Okay, thank you very much, Philip. You've been listening to Philip Ter, Professor of Central European History at the University of Vienna, and author of The Outsiders, Refugees in Europe Since 1492, which is published in the English version by Princeton University Press. Thank you and goodbye.
Yeah, thank you, Robin, and goodbye.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.